Good morning. I'm opening this meeting of the House Committee on Revenue, January 23rd, 2019. Today, we are having an informational meeting on personal income tax. Mr. Alanak.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. So today, the entire meeting, informational meeting, is devoted to the personal income tax. So Kyle Easton, who's the economist handling that area currently, is going to go through in a fair amount of detail through the process.
Welcome.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Kyle Easton, Legislative Revenue Office. And yeah, what I have for you today is just an orientation on the personal income taxes. And here's kind of an overview of what I plan to touch on, but plan to start with just some of the basics of who's filing, and then go through more or less how personal income taxes are computed, the ultimate tax liability. So I'll start at the kind of the sources of income and work my way through really the tax return, because that's probably the best way to think about the flow of the personal income tax and how we get to the net tax liability at the end there. After that, I have some information on Oregon's reduced rates for pass-through income. That's for pass-through entities or taxpayers that have pass-through or certain pass-through income, I should say, and also sole proprietors. So I have some information on that, an update on that. And then I'll finish with just some what's new, what are kind of the current things that have been discussed in some cases in the personal income tax. And then I have a couple slides on other states just to provide a little bit of context there of how Oregon compares to the other states. So before I get going, just a note on the sources. Most of, unless it's otherwise noted in this presentation, the information that's coming from here is coming from the published statistics that come out from the research section of the Department of Revenue. So this is published return information, and because of that, we do have a bit of a delay in the information you'll see. Some of this might be for tax year 2016 or even tax year 2014 might be the most current information that we have. But that's reflected in the slides there. So just something to keep in mind. There is a bit of a delay between when the returns come in and when we have the information to present. Okay, so starting off with just who files the personal income tax. Really, there's three categories here that we have. Full year, part year, and then a non-resident. So the full year resident, I have a little explanation up there, but that's just you're thinking of Oregon as your permanent home. And that's the majority of filers, certainly are full year residents. And then you have a non-resident, which would be someone who lives outside of Oregon, but has some source of income coming from Oregon. And the two examples there might be someone who lives in, say, across the Columbia or across the border, so in Vancouver, Washington, and has a job here in Oregon. So they are paying Oregon income tax as a non-resident in that case. The other might be a taxpayer that has like a landlord or something, so they have income that's coming out of property or something to that effect that they own here in Oregon, and that is also subject to taxation.
Question for you, Representative Rescue.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And how many did you have for today?
One right now.
Okay, you didn't meet your.
I didn't use
goal
all 17
yesterday.
No. Okay, well that's
no,
good.
You have at least one or two left over.
And I have the rest of the session to use those up. Okay, very good. All right. Thanks, Kyle. The question is, what about military personnel that may claim to be an Oregonian but are stationed somewhere else in the world or in another state? Where do they fit in this description?
Yeah, Representative Rushke, I know that's one that's pretty specific. I could get back to you on it. I know we've had legislation in the past on trying to flesh that out a little bit of
okay.
How to handle that. But yeah, I can get more information details.
Thanks.
On that, certainly. So then the last category I have there is the part-year resident. So that's just someone who moved into Oregon during part of the year or moved out of Oregon. So maybe halfway through the year or to that extent, then they're still would have some tax liability based upon the amount of time they were here in Oregon, whether they came in or left during the tax year. And the table that you see there is just showing about 92% of tax liability is coming from full year filers. So it is definitely, it's the full year, and then the non-resident 6% part year, just the about 2%. Okay, so in terms of whether you're a resident or not, the next kind of way to slice the return, so to speak, and you'll hear this come up a lot of times in legislation, so something to keep in mind is just your filing status. And the typical ones, or the ones that we have up there, are single, married filing jointly, married filing separately, head of household, and qualifying widower. So those are the sort of the five filing statuses that someone can file within. So the single, that's maybe pretty self-explanatory. Married filing jointly, again, that's going to be two taxpayers or two filers on a one return. So that'd be married filing jointly. Married filing separately, again, these are going to be two filers or two individuals that rather than filing a joint return, for whatever reason, they've chosen to file married filing separately. And then head of household would be an unmarried taxpayer that also has certain dependents within the home. And they have a certain amount of expenses. So there's an expense requirement in keeping up that home. And the last is the qualifying widower, which is the case where a spouse has died in the previous 2 years and they haven't remarried. And the reason that these are important is it affects sometimes how the standard deduction is calculated or also the income tax brackets and rates. So a lot of times you'll see like a single filer, the married filing jointly will then be double that. So the standard deduction might be double that, or the brackets, the tax brackets are double what the single is. And that's just to account, you now have two people on the return rather than one. I do have an indication of the standard deduction to give some idea how that works. And you can see the idea with the, sometimes with the qualifying widower and the head of household is to bring what would normally be a single person on the return and give them, treat them in some cases more like a married filing jointly. So it gives them some of that, a higher standard deduction or possibly a wider tax bracket and rate, which when you widen the brackets for someone at the lower rates, that reduces their tax liability. Excuse me. And as you can see in the chart and the table that's in front of you, most of our, most of the net tax liability is coming from the joint and the single filers. Head of household of the kind of the smaller three represents about 5%, with the married filing separately and the qualifying widower being a pretty de minimis amount of tax liability.
Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you have historical data for this chart of single joint and so on, going back to say like 1990, just to see if it's been steady at 26 and 68 and 1 and 5, or have we moved in 1990, were there more joint filers or fewer joint filers? I'm just trying to see if there's any kind of trend there.
Yes, Representative, that's something I could put together.
Okay.
Yeah, definitely.
That'd be great. You thought you were coming here just to present. I'm giving you job security is what I'm doing.
Ideas for the next presentation as well. Okay, and then what I have in front of you here is just the standard tax rates and brackets here in Oregon. So again, Oregon has, we have the 5, the 7, the 9, and the 9.9% rates. And you can see the brackets themselves are indexed to inflation. So the bracket will creep up each year. So for 2018, for a single taxpayer, it would be the first 5% is that first $3,450 in income is taxed to the 5%. And then the next increment between $3,450 and $8,700 is taxed to the 7%. And then our 9% bracket is definitely the widest at $8,700 up to $125,000. And then the $125,000 above is then subject to the 9.9%. And one thing to keep in mind is that 9.9%, that bracket, that $125,000 cutoff or $250,000 in the case of a joint return, that's not indexed to inflation. So those ones, everything else, the other parts of the brackets are indexed to inflation, so they go up a little bit each year. But that 9.9%, that's a hard number, the 125 and 250. So that will not creep up each year. But because of our rate structure, the bulk of our the bulk of Oregon income is subject to that 9% tax bracket. So in a lot of cases, that'll be the marginal tax rate for a taxpayer generally. So that next dollar of income will be subject to that 9% rate. Okay, so just stepping into more or less the computation of tax or how we get from income to net tax liability. The flow chart that you see up here really follows the tax return, but it's also a good way to conceptualize how it works. And you start with adjusted gross income. So that's your total income minus some adjustments. And just to back up, actually, I should mention, of course, Oregon's tax system begins with the federal tax system. So Oregon connects the definition of federal taxable income. And because of that, Oregon, then anything that goes into computing the definition of federal taxable income as the starting point, Oregon's connected to. And that's something you'll hear in the committee is our connection to the federal taxable income. And then all the policy decisions or all that goes into determining taxable income is something we have here in Oregon. And that's why one of the reasons, because the definition of taxable income is post, say, deductions, Oregon has, by default, has connected to federal deductions. And certainly Oregon has done this in the past, is you can disconnect from those. So the way to do that is to add them back to the Oregon return. So if Oregon wanted to disconnect from a certain itemized deduction, Oregon was just put in place a addition to Oregon taxable income equal to, in some cases, what was deducted on the federal, at the federal level, or subject to the federal deduction statutes. So that's kind of the way that it works, whereas the default is connected to federal definition of taxable income, and then you can kind of opt out from different provisions if the legislature so chooses. But so again, adjusted gross income starts with the total income on the return, whether that's wages, it could be capital gains, interest earnings, those type of things. And then you have the adjustments, which are often returned to or referred to as above the line deductions. And adjustments work the same as a deduction. You have your income amount, and then you deduct something from that. But for above the line deduction or a subtract, an adjustment, you don't have to itemize. And that's the key there. So it's available to all taxpayers, not just those that itemize their deductions. But so that gets you to adjusted gross income. And so the next step there is then to add those Oregon additions. And this might be where Oregon has disconnected from something in federal tax law. And then, so you add the additions, then minus subtractions. And that's something Oregon has put in place to subtract from your income. So it's going to reduce your tax liability is the idea there. And it's important to remember, or I guess to point out, that while these originate in Oregon statute, some of these might be put in place because of requirements in federal law, where Oregon, the states in general, may not have the authority to tax some type of income. So in some cases, these might be discretionary, the subtractions, and others, they might be requirements that are in Oregon statute, but they're required by federal law for some reason. And the next step would be subtracting deductions. So taxpayers in Oregon do have two choices, more or less. You can take the standard deduction, or you can itemize your deduction. And one of the things in Oregon is our standard deduction is lower than the federal standard deductions. And especially after the most recent changes, and I'll touch on this a little bit more later, at the federal level with the Tax Cut and Jobs Act from December of 2017, the itemized deduction at the federal level went up significantly. So we're at about $12,000 for a single filer and $24,000 for a joint filer. Here in Oregon, we're lower than that, and I'll get to the specifics later. But the takeaway for right now is we will see more tax filers that are taking the standard deduction at the federal level and then itemizing here in Oregon. So they'll be doing two different, I guess, in terms of how you'd claim the itemized deductions, you actually fill out the Schedule A. At the federal level, you take the standard deduction, and here in Oregon, you'll actually have to track those and itemize your deductions. So we'll see kind of two ways in which taxpayers will be filing that. And that's something we'll see a little bit differently going forward since the changes at the federal level, where I think the last estimate we put out, we were expecting federal itemizers to be about 15% of all returns. And in Oregon, we'd expect it to be 45-50%, more or less 50-50 of those that itemize and those take the standard deduction. So after you subtract your deductions, you get to Oregon taxable income. And so that's the income that you then apply against Oregon's tax rates. And again, that's using the brackets, so the 5, the 7, the 9, and possibly the 9.9%. And you come up with what we would refer to as the gross tax. And then the next step there, the final step really, is to apply any Oregon credits you might have. So you come up with your gross tax, apply the credits, and that results in the net tax. And again, that's where you get to the credits. In some cases, if you have a credit that's a what is referred to as a non-refundable credit, that could bring your tax liability to zero. There are also refundable credits. The earned income credit is probably the best example, where they're called refundable because they can reduce your tax liability below zero. So if you have a tax liability of $100 and you have a credit that's refundable worth $200, you reduce your tax liability by $100, and then you also actually reduce it an additional $100 to go into the negative, more or less, and you get that refunded back to you or sent back to you as a refund when you file your taxes. And so what I plan to do here is I'll just step through each of kind of the boxes that you see in the flow chart and just give you a little background on it, and also hit on what are the largest provisions within each of these categories. So in terms of adjusted gross income, you can see in 2016, it was about $116 billion. And then additions represented about $500 million. Subtraction, so again, additions bring the taxable income up, or then come up, and then subtractions of about $11.8 billion and deductions of $16.2. So when you add those and then subtract the subtractions and deductions, you're left with a taxable income of about $91.2 billion in tax year 2016. That nets out or grosses to a tax of $7.7 billion. We had about $800 million in credits, which brought the net tax liability down to $6.9 billion for tax year 2016. And so that's basically the flow chart that I just talked about and how you get to the actual numbers that show up at the end there. So, and that's for the one tax year as well. In terms of the income, so how you get to that adjusted gross income, the components there you can see is still dominated at this time by wages. They represent about 66% of the income on the return. A note on the data here, this is information that's coming from the federal 1040, so it doesn't necessarily track specifically if Oregon has a disconnect, if there's a subtraction or something related to this income. It may not connect directly to the numbers you see here, and that the best example that would be the retirement, the retirement category, which is at 14% federal. One of the differences with Oregon is Oregon doesn't tax any Social Security benefits. So at the federal level, some Social Security benefits are not taxed. Oregon then doesn't tax the additional amount that is taxed at the federal level. So Oregon does not tax any Social Security benefits, and that would reduce the retirement income you see up there a bit as well, that category. So it's just something to note, but it still gives, in terms of just getting a general sense of what are the sources of income here in Oregon, this chart still works pretty well. But as you can see, it wages, retirement, business, about 11%, so that's going to be coming through either a sole proprietorship, or it could also be business income from pass-throughs, S corporations, partnerships, and the like. So anything that's business related, but it's not C corps. So that would be the corporate excise or income tax. So that's excluded here, but business income that's coming through the personal income tax, that's what's included in the business category there. And then you can see net capital gains and dividends and interest rounded out there. In terms of additions, Oregon additions, the largest single one is the interest on state and local bonds outside of Oregon. Accounts for about 35%, and then you have the all other category. But again, this is about $500 million, so relatively small in the whole scheme of things, just to go back one or two. It's about $500 million out of that $115 billion or so. So it's in terms of the overall income, the additions represent a pretty small amount. And again, additions a lot of times might account for where Oregon has disconnected from federal provisions. An example I have up there is depreciation differences, and that's something that the legislature is probably familiar with from about 10 years ago. Chris can definitely remember some of this as well, where it was during running up or into the last, some of the recessions, or the recession in the early 2000s. There were provisions at the federal level to change depreciation to spur, in some cases, or the idea was to spur maybe business investment. But at the same time, you're giving up revenue in the short term, because depreciation changing, depreciation schedule should more or less net out over the long term. But if you allow accelerated depreciation or businesses to more quickly write off new investments, that can reduce your tax liability in the short term, but increase it more or less, or even out in the long term. Where if previously you would depreciate over 15 years rather than over 1 year, you can see how it just spreads out sort of the revenue impact. And at the federal level, it can make those changes. Again, the federal level, there's deficit spending. Here in Oregon, sometimes when you see your slide into a recession, that's where Oregon has disconnected in the past, because to stay with those provisions would reduce revenues here in Oregon. So it's kind of that balancing. But that's an example of additions that we've seen here in Oregon is disconnecting from that accelerated depreciation. So moving on to the subtractions, again, this is for tax year 2016. And you can see the largest one there is the federal tax subtraction, so for tax liability. So in Oregon, you can subtract up to a certain amount, and dependent upon your income, it is, we do have a max amount that's indexed to inflation, and then also it phases out as your income goes up. But the general idea is you can subtract from your Oregon income that would be subject to taxation the amount that you paid at the federal level in taxes. And so that that provision is one of the reasons why when the feds change something related to taxation at the federal level, even if there's nothing that connects directly to Oregon through deductions or something to that effect, so maybe at the federal level they change a credit, if it changes net tax liability at the federal level, we'll see that filter through to Oregon through this federal tax subtraction. So if you decrease taxes on average at the federal level, you're going to decrease the federal tax subtraction we have in Oregon. So a lot of times we'll see a revenue lift, even if it's slight here in Oregon, just from the fact that you're now subtracting less than you're paying at the federal level.
Kyle, I'd like you to talk about something at more like the 30 or 50,000 foot level for a minute. When the legislature determines that it's a good idea to stimulate some sort of economic behavior or activity, give a break for doing something that has social benefit, help us understand the logic behind why sometimes what's proposed is a credit and sometimes it's better to enact a subtraction or a deduction. How should we look at these things? What's the better thing to do? Is it to individual benefit the individual taxpayer? Is it because it works better for calculating taxes? Because it works better to stimulate the behavior that you're looking for? How do you choose among those different kinds of breaks or benefits?
Yeah, Madam Chair. A deduction, a subtraction, or a credit, they can work in different ways. So mm-hmm. That's probably step one is with a deduction, it requires you to itemize to receive that. So in cases of, especially when you see some of the lower income returns, they're more likely to take the standard deduction, or if you don't own property or something of that, that's going to get you into the itemized deduction. A new deduction may or may not help your target group. So that's one reason, just right off the mm-hmm. right from the start, you may not want to use a deduction or some other means just because you're trying to target a certain group that may or may not be using the itemized deduction. In terms of a subtraction or a credit,
that one really interests me. Choice.
So the credit. A credit is a dollar-for-dollar reduction in tax. So that's one of the easy, it's maybe a little bit more straightforward to think about it, where if you give someone a subtraction from their income, so if you reduce their income by $100, their potential net tax benefit is that $100 times whatever their marginal tax rate is. Mm-hmm. So it might be, if they're at the 9%, you're talking a $9 reduction in tax, where a $100 credit would reduce their tax liability by $100, assuming they have tax liability. So that's where sometimes it might be you need to scale them. You can try to reach the same desired effect, but you might need to scale a subtraction that much greater than a credit. And then also credits, the refundability provision, I think, is probably the biggest piece. If the intent or the policy intent is to have some desired outcome that's going to affect taxpayers that don't have tax liability, then you're not necessarily going to be able to help them without doing a refundable tax credit. So if you add a subtraction, but they already have no income that's subject to taxation, again, you're not reducing their tax liability below zero. And that's, I think, a reason to look at refundable credits come up, especially when you're targeting some of that that low income, or it could be something where it's like there's no income to tax at the beginning. Maybe it's a startup business or something to that effect as well. Another thing to keep in mind is also allowing carry forwards. We've seen that. So it's not always desirable maybe to use a refundable credit, but you can allow that carry forward going forward. So if you have $200 in tax liability of a $500 credit, you can reduce your tax liability by $200 this year, and then you'd carry forward the remaining $300 and potentially use it in a later tax year. But again, that can work out in some cases, but in other, it may not be as desirable because $200 now and then $300 in the next year, that's kind of pushing out the time horizon of when you're receiving that benefit. So if the idea is to spur something more immediately or a kind of a social benefit more immediately, that's where a refundable credit might be more useful. And I think part of it is just maybe even how to think about it, where one is just saying, we don't want to tax this income, so therefore we'll make it non-taxable. And it's like, okay, well, we're not taxing that source of income, as opposed to a credit, which kind of disconnects just that income and the amount. Mm-hmm. So if it's just saying, well, that type of income seems like a source that Oregon doesn't want to tax, you might just make that a subtraction, and then it's just not part of the tax return. So conceptually, it might make some sense, I suppose, in that way as well.
Since we do now look at all tax expenditures, it's helpful to remember the array of different kinds of tax expenditures. Representative Finley.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Kyle, you made a statement, and I guess I didn't understand or didn't think about it. To get a tax deduction, you have to itemize. Is the same true for a tax credit?
Representative Finley, no. Yeah, the credit would be available to anybody who's filing and, yeah, would qualify. So that's a big key difference between the two. Yeah. Okay. Just finishing up with the subtractions here, I think, I spoke to the federal tax liability. The next subtraction we see is that Social Security. Again, that's that the additional benefits that are still taxed at the federal level, Oregon has chosen, or it's in Oregon's constitution, has chosen not to tax those. So that's a fairly sizable subtraction as well. And then you get into some of the smaller subtractions you can see there in the table.
Yes, Representative Rushkey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Kyle, could you do something for us and take a single filer making $50,000 and say if they got a $1,000 deduction, a $1,000 credit, and a $1,000 subtraction, kind of run through those scenarios to see where the taxable income ends up in a scenario with each one of those? That be possible to do something like that? Or maybe that's a bad example. Maybe there's a better way to do it. But I'd like to take the same dollar amount as a credit, a deduction, or subtraction in the code, and the same income, and kind of figure out what benefits, you know, where we end up in each one of those scenarios.
Yeah, certainly, Representative. Put together, if I'm understanding, kind of a chart that would show maybe typical, four or five typical taxpayers and
Just kind of the same scenario, if it was done as a deduction versus a credit versus and so on.
Yeah. Yeah, that's something we could definitely put together.
That would help email out. Help this representative.
It's a good idea. Great idea.
Thanks. Keeping you employed.
Okay, so I alluded to this a little bit previously, but the next slide I have here is about federal and Oregon deductions. And again, I mentioned this, the general idea was with the Tax Cut and Jobs Act, the TCJA, this was passed in, again, I said December of 2017, so it's first effective in tax year 2018. So that'll be the returns that people are filing here or starting to file right now this spring. But at the federal level, there was quite a few changes made in the Tax Cut and Jobs Act, but one of the sizable ones was the standard deduction. And so the federal standard deduction was really increased significantly. You can see there from 2017, from about $6,300 and $12,700 for the joint up to $12,000 and $24,000. And what we have there are sort of projections or estimates of prior to the Tax Cut and Jobs Act, about 40% of Oregon income tax filers were itemizing on their federal return. We would expect that to be about 15% going forward. So we'll get an idea where that is in another year or so when we can look at the 2018 returns. But here in Oregon, we wouldn't expect, whether you itemize or not, to budge much. We stay consistent about 45%. And again, that's because for Oregon, our standard deduction is unchanged. It's not connected to the federal deduction anyway. It's just our standard deduction then gets indexed for inflation. But so that's kind of key in some cases for Oregon tax filers that they're filing at the federal and the Oregon level is they may no longer be seeing a benefit from, say, like the home mortgage interest deduction at the federal level, but they are still here in Oregon. So that can change the dynamic of the benefit they're receiving or how they may react to those type of incentives or benefits or however you want to characterize them. A couple of other things on the Tax Cut and Jobs Act changes that were made at the federal level that do filter here to Oregon. One that I think is discussed quite a bit is what's considered the SALT deduction cap. So when we say SALT, it's the state and local taxes. And so at the federal level, there was a cap of $10,000 on what you could deduct. So before the Tax Cut and Jobs Act, you could deduct, or you can deduct your state and local taxes on your federal return, and then that filters here to Oregon. But now there's a hard cap of $10,000. So the idea would be you would sum your state income tax and your local taxes, which is going to be the property tax. And if those two sum to, say, $12,000, you could have deducted $12,000 from your income at the federal level. Now that would be capped at $10,000. So instead of deducting $12,000 or reducing your income by $12,000, you now can only reduce it by $10,000. So in a way, you now have $2,000 more in income that's subject to taxation at the federal level. So the first initial effect of the SALT cap on Oregon taxpayers is it affects their federal tax liability. And that can filter through to Oregon, but also the cap of $10,000 is effective here in Oregon. But a key difference for when you're filing in Oregon is Oregon already didn't allow you to deduct your personal income taxes, your Oregon personal income taxes from your income when you're figuring your Oregon income taxes. So there'd be kind of a circularity there. So that was already not allowed here in Oregon. So the $10,000 SALT cap for Oregon filers filing their Oregon taxes really is limiting more or less their property taxes. At $10,000. And that's why we see this SALT cap is going to impact more Oregon filers at the federal level than it will when they're filing their Oregon taxes. Excuse me, because it's going to require to really impact someone here in Oregon when they're filing their Oregon taxes, they're going to need property taxes greater than $10,000 because they're not summing those, their state income taxes as well. So the effect of that SALT cap on Oregon taxes is different. Certainly, it's far more limited than it is at the federal level. But it is still there, so it's something to keep in mind. Some of the other changes we had is the repeal of the what's known as the PEAS limitation, itemized deduction. So before there was a limit on your itemized deductions that you could take, with the idea being there's at some point it gets so high that they wanted to put a limit on that. That has been eliminated at the federal level, so that automatically eliminates any limit that we had in Oregon because we were connected to it. So we had that PEAS limitation here, so that will allow potentially more itemized deductions to be claimed. There are some slight changes or some changes to the mortgage interest deduction and the home equity deductibility. There was an elimination of the certain miscellaneous deductions. So these, the biggest example there was the unreimbursed employee expenses. So those have been eliminated and they were eliminated at the federal level. So then they're automatically eliminated here in Oregon as well. And then there was a slight percentage increase on the limits on deductibility of charitable donations. So those are, again, changes that filter here to Oregon. And absent any law change by the legislature, that's where Oregon's automatically connected to those. So things to keep in mind, I suppose, going forward. The next slide I have here was just on the standard and itemized deductions. Here in Oregon, you can see in terms of numbers, it's about 55% or so of returns are taking the standard deduction, 45% are taking the itemized. But the amount of the deductions is definitely skewed towards the itemizers. And that goes, I suppose that's going to happen just by the fact everybody gets the standard deduction, you only take your itemized deductions if they're greater than the standard deduction. But you can see that while the split in terms of the number of returns is about 45-55, itemized deductions account for 83% of the amount deducted, and this was back in 2014. So most of the deductions are on the itemized deductions. So just a listing of the largest itemized deductions. Number one, there's the home mortgage interest, followed by charitable, and then property taxes. Then we get into medical expenses and the net limited miscellaneous. Again, this is for the tax year 2014, so we could see some change going forward. Again, it's going to be another year or two before we have, well, actually, there's going to be several years before we have information on deductions post Tax Cut and Jobs Act. There is a delay in when we get these returns. but we should, by all indications, I wouldn't expect these categories to shift too much. I mean, this is still probably pretty representational for the ones that are still allowed, I suppose. The home mortgage, charitable, we would still expect there to be number one, number two on the list going forward as well.
Kyle, will we be getting any additional detail about property taxes and home mortgage interest in another presentation?
Madam Chair, certainly can. I do have one more slide that touches on just kind of the revenue impact of it, but that's something we definitely have information on that, and if it's an interest of the committee, we can definitely piece that apart a little bit more.
Okay, and the other question is, does Department of Revenue have information available, more detail about charitable contributions?
Madam Chair, they are split into three categories, but there's still three very broad categories. But if you're saying like trying to think of like a listing of the types mm-hmm. that's charitably mm-hmm. contributed, I don't believe we'd capture that information because it's
What are Oregonians supporting with their charitable contributions? I'd be interested to know what we can know about that. So if they, for example, have a web page or if there's something on our transparency website, you could just send a link to it for us to look at the information?
For the most part, the information comes from Schedule A.
Okay.
And so if you think of it, for anybody who itemizes, if you think about how you fill out Schedule mm-hmm. A and if you make those charitable contributions, mm-hmm. if you're not providing the detailed list of where that's going to, then it's not available on this end. Mm-hmm. Now, for some of the larger contributions, there are additional forms mm-hmm. that need to be filed. So that's one potential avenue that
okay.
we could explore.
Good. Thank you.
Okay, so the next slide I have here, this is actually citing information from the governor's tax expenditure report, and it's just more or less taking those deductions amount and trying to put a number in terms of the revenue reduction. Because again, the previous number here is talking about what's actually deducted, but to get it, well, what's the effect of that deduction? It's more or less that deduction amount multiplied by the taxpayer's tax rate. But again, you can see in terms of scale, home mortgage interest for the biennium, the 1921 biennium was estimated about $912 million. Charitables coming out at 488, it's about $500 million. And then property taxes is just behind it there at 458. So that's to put like a dollar amount in your mind of what that deduction actually translates into. And again, this was on the last slide as well. It is heavily weighted, right? There's just a few deductions that make up a large number of that, right? That's the, going back to the percentages, the charitable and the home mortgage interest make up about 60%. You put in property taxes, you're now at 80% of all itemized deductions are right there. and then something to keep in mind with itemized deductions is there is a stacking. So one of the things that we'll see if we're making estimates on making a change to the itemized deductions is if you reduce or eliminate an itemized deduction, then that could potentially move that person as a taking the standard deduction. So there's not necessarily a dollar for dollar change. Excuse me. If you take away like if you were to reduce $100 in deduction, that may not net to $100 increase in taxable income because it could be that switch really only cost the taxpayer like $80 because now they're shifted to the standard deduction. But that's pretty inside baseball, I suppose. I'll skip through the examples because I think I've talked through that a few times now. So moving on to the personal income tax credits. So what I have in front of you here, these are the credits and the amount on personal income taxes. So there are certain cases where credit can be taken both at the personal level and the corporate level. This would only contain the information if this is a credit that can be taken both by a personal and a corporate entity. It would only show that of the personal, because that's the focus here. And the first one, the largest credit by far, is the personal exemption credit. So this is a credit. It's about, I think it was $200. It's indexed to inflation, but it's, for the most part, it's a credit that all Oregon taxpayers are going to benefit from. And in some cases, it was viewed years ago as almost part of the tax base. And this followed in line with what was in the federal tax code, if they had personal exemption, where it worked more as akin to a deduction, back to the conversation about deduction versus credit. And Oregon was choosing more or less to just provide a credit. So to reduce tax liability, we already have the standard deduction, but this would also reduce tax liability for all taxpayers by a certain amount. So in some cases, it would reduce just the base personal income tax amount. a change that was made a few years back was to eliminate the personal exemption credit for taxpayers of higher income. And so that's listed for that'd be a single filer with $100,000 or greater than $100,000 in adjusted gross income, or for a joint filer, it was $200,000. And that's where they would no longer receive that credit worth about $200. But so the personal exemption, yeah, that's about $500 million there. And then we get down to taxes paid to other states. That's another credit that's probably a better example of just being part of the tax base. So again, going all the way back to the start of the presentation and the discussion about Oregon residents, part year residents, and non-residents. And if a Oregon resident or part year resident, they have, say, income from another state, Oregon will tax that if you're an Oregon resident, but you do get a credit to offset if the other state that you're maybe earning that money in, say you own a home in another state that you're renting out or something like that, so you have income coming from another state, Oregon can allow you to offset that through this credit to help avoid that double taxation, so to speak. But if that other state is not taxing it, Oregon will tax that as income because you're a resident. So again, that's both the personal exemption and the taxes, the credit for taxes paid to other states, are examples of credits that don't have a sunset. Whereas in nearly every case, tax credits will have a sunset. And in fact, it's a requirement now in statute of we have this default 6-year tax credit sunset for any modified or new credit that comes into place. So that's why, and that's part of the whole how just we have the tax credit report and how the committees, both on the Senate side and the House side, have come to view credits as this staggered sunset. So there's always a group of credits that are scheduled to sunset and then reviewed each of the long sessions.
I have a question about tax paid to other states. Does every other state reciprocate with a similar action?
That's a good question. I don't know. I mean, certainly we have a few other states that don't have any personal income tax. But that's, I could look into that a little bit because, yeah, I don't know how common that is that they do the same thing where they try to offset it the same as Oregon, I suppose. But it's something we could look into, yeah. So just working down the list, the next, I suppose the next credit that's outside of sort of a base credit would be the earned income and the working family child care. Now these are both refundable credits. The earned income credit, again, that's a credit that in Oregon we have that's a specified percentage of the federal one. So right now under current law, and this is a credit that will be up for review during this session, Oregon's earned income tax credit is 8%, is kind of the standard default, and then it can go up to 11% for tax returns that have a dependent under the age of 3 for the tax year. So you get a higher percentage of the federal credit if you have, say, like a dependent or a child under the age of 3. So that change was made a few years ago as well to expand it or increase the credit for those taxpayers a bit. The residential energy, this is a credit that has expired. It's still included here because there is, again, we have some of that carry forward. There's a bit of a tail on this one. So we still see some revenue impact that's showing up, but absent any changes in our current law, that'll just slowly fade out in the upcoming years.
Over how many years?
Off the top of my head, I can't remember
something more than one or two.
It's Chris might know if it's five.
It's five to start with.
Usually, it's probably
five. Yeah.
Okay.
So, yeah, it's definitely, I can remember like the trend in the spreadsheet that I have here of it dwindling away. And then the last two that I have here that really are of substantial value, or depending on how you look at it, is the political contributions and the Oregon Cultural Trust donation. And again, these are two credits that will be in front of the committee as well, because they're up for sunset review this session as well. So all told, that's about $771 million in credits. Okay, so the next part, so moving a little bit away from just the base orientation, is the an update, and we've done this in the past, but I wanted to include it here a little bit, is more or less an update on Oregon's reduced rates for certain income of pass-through and sole proprietors. So this was put in place, enacted back in 2013, and then the special session that we had the previous year in 2018 expanded this to sole proprietors as well. So that's just to kind of connect that there, that's what the special session was about, is this provision as well. Now again, it's too early for us right now to have any information on what that expansion to sole proprietors resulted in. The information I have here will be for tax year 2017, so it's we don't have that change from the sole proprietors yet included here. But the general idea here again was Oregon put in place tax rates that are lower tax rates that would be applied to specified income. And this was from House Bill 3601 in 2013. And the income here would be non-passive income that's coming from a partnership, an S-corp, a sole proprietorship, and an LLC. So these are referred to as pass-throughs. So this is generally, it's going to be S-corp and partnerships, but within those, there can be that LLCs can show up there, and that's why we're including them as well. And they can also show up as a sole proprietor too. The policy behind this was to be directed at non-passive income. So again, that's the requirement there. It's in quotes, is the general idea was to focus on those individuals that are actively participating in the pass-through entity. So whether it's the S-corp or the partnership. So it's not a taxpayer that just owns a stake in one of these businesses, but is actively participating in some capacity. And that's where they would have it reported on the Schedule E, for example, would be non-passive income. So those are really that are working in that business, not just somebody who provided seed money maybe years ago and just gets dividend through it. The other requirements are to have the entity itself must have at least one full-time non-investor employee, and then the qualifying employees must work at least 1,200 hours in Oregon. So again, that was looking at sort of a two requirements. There's a full-time employee and the number of hours there as well, and that would be a non-investor employee, with the idea being that's a true employee, not an owner of the business working at the business, wouldn't count as the employee. So you are employing at least one person. But so the tax rates that I have here is just for a comparison, is we have the joint income tax rates, our standard rates, the 5, the 7, the 9, and the 9.9. And then for the non-passive income, these are the reduced rates. You can see, so anything less than $250,000 would be getting that 7%. Rate, $250,000 to $500,000, 7.2, and so on until you get to the over $5 million in this non-passive income that is then subject to the 9.9. So at that point, it's more or less the same rates, because that's where Oregon standard rates top out as well. Now, the calculation in applying these rates is what I have on the slide in front of you, and the general takeaway here is it's an opt-in, so it's optional for the taxpayer. So if there's a benefit from using these tax rates, the taxpayer can opt in to use it. If it doesn't benefit them, they are not required to use the other rates. So these reduced rates won't result in a net tax increase. If the calculation does, the taxpayer will stick with the standard rates. So the general idea is it can only really help you. It's not designed to hurt anyone in any way. And the reason for that is when you take your non-passive income as a taxpayer, so you receive some non-passive income from, say, an S corporation, you then more or less pull it off your return and you apply these other rates. But when you do that, you no longer get to use your deductions and such on your tax return to reduce that non-passive income. So that non-passive income comes off the return in a way and is applied to these rates without any deductions or anything to reduce it down. And that's where it's going to depend upon the taxpayer and how their return is set up, whether they have other income coming in from wages or other businesses or something of that sort, on whether they do actually benefit from opting into this. But again, that's part of the reason that it is an opt-in to make it optional is you can see instances where you could even have two individuals that both receive income from the same partnership or the same S-Corp. And because of the situation on their return, one may benefit from using these rates, so they opt in, and the other may not, because of, again, the structure of their return. So it's not really an entity that benefits from these. It's the individuals that are getting the income from the pass-through entity. And that'll depend upon their return and on what type of benefit they receive. So in terms of the 2017 numbers, what I have on the slide here is just the number starts off with the full year filers. So it's about 1.8 million total filers here in Oregon, and the claimants for these reduced rates was about 21,000. It was 21,289. And again, this is, I should note, these are preliminary numbers that we have for 2017. So it does change a little bit, but based upon what 2016 did with the actuals, it doesn't move a whole lot based upon past experience. So you can see overall the returns that are using these reduced rates represent about 1.2% of the total of that 1.8 million returns. But you can see the share definitely depends upon the amount of income. So as you move up the amount of income that's on that return to even above 500,000, you start to see this opt-in approach these lower rates at 31%. And of the 1.8 million returns, plenty of those returns don't have any income from a pass-through entity. So just right off the bat, many returns are just simply a wage earner or something to that effect. So it's a small subset of returns that even has any income from either an S-Corp or a partnership to begin with. And of those, we do see whether or not you opt in or not. But it does give some sense of where this opt-in or where these reduced rates sort of apply to all the tax returns we have here in Oregon. And then the revenue impact you can see is also generally about 70% of that is showing up in returns of income over 500,000. And again, part of that is just by the very structure is the reduced rates. The more income you have that's subject to those reduced rates, the greater net benefit or total benefit you're going to have overall, because you have more of that that's being applied to a reduced rate. So next up here is, these are the tax numbers or the numbers on the reduced rate use and impact for tax year 2016 and 2017. So this same information for tax year 2016 was presented to the committees a year ago. And what this is just a comparison between tax year 2016 and 2017 to give some sense of what changes have we seen year over year. And in terms of the overall impact, you can see in tax year 2016, it was about $95.3 million reduction in tax. In tax year 2017, it was 95.9. So we've seen very little. It's more or less just flat from year over year. So very little additional benefit from tax year 2016. And in fact, the chart or the table to the in the top right there shows the number of claimants, which we actually saw that go down. So in 2016, it was 22,448. 2017, that dropped to 21,289. And most of that drop, as you can see from the percentage changes there, are in the lower income of the categories there, where we saw a reduction in those 0 to 50,000 is down 30%. But overall, again, that's relatively flat, I suppose, down about 5%. But it is interesting to see that we've actually seen usage of this go down year over year.
Yes, Representative Rush.
Thank you, Chair. The change that we made in 2018 in the special session to extend to sole proprietors is effective. Is that effective for the 2018 tax year?
Yes.
So in a few months, we'll have some idea of whether that and the number of claimants was significantly impacted by that.
Yes, Representative Marsh, it'll be this time next year, really, we're going to see.
We've been able to assess everything.
A lot of people that are taking these reduced rates don't. They file extensions, so they're not going to file until the fall really that will see this. So, and that's part of the reason this is preliminary numbers is Department of Revenue has given us some, these are unpublished technically numbers. This is just what they have from the preliminary runs based on some of that raw information. But yeah, that's, and that's where what we've done the past 2 years now, I think, is in early January or so, we've brought this to the committee. It's just an update mm-hmm. similar to this to give some sense of that. So that'll be, yeah, next year will be our first look of what did that change the of adding the sole proprietors? How did that affect these underlying numbers?
Gotcha. Thank you.
Okay, so included here is more or less going back to the original estimate of back in 2013 and comparing that to what we've seen. And the original estimate is there, that's the top table. And then the second table is showing those individual tax years. So it's taking that biennial estimate, I suppose, and breaking that into the actual tax years. And this is for what you're seeing here is the biennial estimate, the top table, that was the total revenue impact. And then the information I've been providing here is just for the full year filers. We don't have the part year and the non-residents in here. So those numbers aren't necessarily one-to-one. We usually see the part year non-resident can anywhere from 10, 5% or so of the total revenue impact. But in tax year 2015, the estimate made in the revenue impact that accompanied House Bill 3601 was expecting about $91 million, $91.1 million revenue impact. What we saw was about 66.3. So we didn't see the revenue impact that we were expecting. Some of the feedback heard that the committee heard in testimony was there was a certainly less people thought that they'd benefit from this than they otherwise probably would have. So we didn't see as many tax returns opting into this as probably could have benefited. So part of that was just kind of maybe the slow uptick in the usage of this. So the tax year 2016 number of 98.5 was the estimate, and we saw about 95.3 was our preliminary number at that time. So that was pretty close. That was about $3.2 million difference. And the thinking there was, okay, well now people are aware of this and we've really starting to see usage of what we'd expect, where this is really, no one's missing out on this at this point because they didn't run the computation or their CPA wasn't, maybe didn't notice it or something to that effect. So we saw the usage pick up here. And then in 2017, the original estimate had some growth built into this. We were expecting about $105.6 million, and again, it's been relatively flat year over year, so we're at that 95.9. So we're coming in a bit below now the original revenue impact. So it'll be definitely something we'll be keep an eye on going forward. Again, we the next year's data that we'll have will include those sole proprietors, so it'll no longer be comparing to this impact. It'll be this impact plus the impact that came out in special session. So for the tax reduction distribution, this is again for, this is just the tax year 2017 number. It, what's being displayed here is the amount of the tax cut and the number of returns that are benefiting from that tax cut. So to give you some sense of, well, is most of the reduction, is it a small reduction or is it some tax filers that have large reductions? Like what's accounting for this? And you can see the overall share of just that first category. So they're receiving, these are taxpayers that are receiving a benefit of less than $5,000, accounts for about 23.5% of the total tax cut. So it's more or less, there's 16,000 or so returns. There's a lot of returns that are receiving a small tax cut. And that's where that accounts for nearly a quarter of the total benefit. And then you can work your way down to say the top tax cut. And the tax cut does top out eventually because at some point you go back to the 9.9% rate. So that top tax cut is a little bit less than $80,000. But you can see those that receive between $75,000 to $80,000 in tax reduction, there's about there's 62 of those, and they account for about 5% of the total estimate. So it can give you some sense here of, well, where is this reduction in tax? Is it a lot of people getting a little, or some people getting a lot of benefit? And it is somewhat spread throughout, where you do see it's definitely more tilted towards the, I'd say, the those returns that have less of this non-passive income. So there's a higher number of them that are receiving some of that smaller benefit. In terms of the claimants, it's definitely tilted towards more of those that are taking that smaller benefit. So we see a lot of, about 88% of all returns that are claiming this have less than $10,000 in non-passive income. So just to give some sense that it is, most of it is these smaller tax cuts. And then, of course, those with the larger tax cut push change the distribution, I suppose, of the overall tax benefit. Because one tax return that's benefiting $80,000 is going to sway that more than one that's benefiting $5,000.
Thank you. Kyle, can you help me understand sort of the implications of that? If there's a lot of people who have less than $10,000 in income to report, does that imply, so, but they're finding it financially to their advantage to still go down the path of not taking their deductions. So is an implication there that they may have another source of income that accommodates their deductions?
Yes, Representative Marsh, that's right on. You would expect if you have a small amount of passive income, if you have to give up all your deductions and that was your only source of income, you're not going to opt in.
Right.
And that's what we've seen. So it could be they have other income, or on a joint return, it certainly could be your spouse has wage income. And so you're continuing to take your deductions on that wage income. And then this is just applied to the tax rate. So that is, to your point, in a lot of cases, it's going to take a filer, especially that only has a little bit of this non-passive income, to have some other type of income on their return to benefit from these reduced rates, because you are giving up those deductions. So that's the type of return we'd see, is you probably want other sources of income to continue to benefit from your deductions and such. And then when you move this income over to the reduced rates, you're not penalized because you're still able to use those deductions against other income on your return.
So is it totally unreasonable to theorize that this non-passive income is probably a less substantial part of the overall income of the household? I mean, if it's $10,000, somehow they've got other income that's substantial enough to absorb the deductions.
In some cases, yeah, we've looked at some cross tabs in the past that have looked at that. There can also be, for these type of returns, you can have business losses showing up as well in other cases. So we've seen returns that you could think hypothetically where you have a loss on maybe a different business or something like that, or you have losses going on, and then you have this income as well. And that's where you may not opt in at this point because you have losses over here. But certainly, yeah, that's in some of the, I guess, the cross tabulations we've looked at in the past, you can see some of that where you're definitely to benefit from this. And if you only have $10,000 in this non-passive income, you probably have some other source of income, certainly. And for those, if you're part of an S-Corp, there's a very good chance you're earning a wage from that S-Corp as well if you're materially participating. So you could have dual income from the same source or the same entity in that case that would show up there. So, yeah.
I'd like to do a quick time check. It's my understanding from the Speaker's office that our aim is to conclude by 9:45. I'm willing to let it go just a few minutes past that, but we have, what, maybe just 5 more slides?
Yeah.
Let's see if we can get through them
today.
No problem.
Okay, so the last one I think I had on the pass-through, this is by county. I suppose the takeaway here is just we have returns that are showing up all throughout the Oregon's 36 counties that are utilizing this reduced rates. But unsurprisingly, it is where the spread is not even between all the 36 counties. There's definitely ones that where you'd expect the higher population counties are having higher use of this. Lastly, there is a policy adjustment embedded in these reduced rates, and that's, I believe, actually, I need to double check this now with the special session if we adjusted this or not. So we did not. Chris is shaking his head. Okay. Where there's almost a built-in, where if the revenue impact is more or less different by more than 25%, we'll take a look, LR will take a look, and they can adjust these rates going forward. So there was kind of a mechanism built into place. These rates in 2022 could be adjusted upward or downward, depending upon what the revenue impact is that we're seeing coming through. So it was kind of a built-in trigger mechanism there, I suppose.
Just to add to that, the first bullet point mentions the July 1, 2018, and there was no adjustment to the rates then, given the experience over the first 2 years.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so what's new? Federal Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, that was a big one. made changes to rates, deductions, and other provisions. Now, again, rates and credits at the federal level don't directly impact Oregon except through federal or subtraction for federal taxes. But it's just a note that that was a sizable change there, and we'll see that starting to show up as taxpayers file this year. And the reduced rates, we had the 2018 session and the 2018 special session is just some of those things that have changed recently. And then just the last two slides I have here is relating to other states. Just to give the committee a general sense, for those states that have personal income taxes, most of the other states are connecting to AGI. Now, it's not the actual split. It was the majority of them, but that's certainly not the case that all of them are connected to AGI. But there's certainly a large share of states that connect to adjusted gross income. And then there are states that they don't connect to adjusted gross income, but rather could connect to the definition of taxable income. And that's where Oregon is. So if you're thinking as a state you want to connect to something at the federal level, those are usually the two points in which to choose: federal adjusted gross income or federal taxable income. And the difference there is just federal taxable income is kind of further down that flow chart. So the further down you are, the more you incorporate into Oregon's tax system as a default. Where if you start with adjusted gross income, you get income and adjustments, but you're not automatically connected to the deductions. And that's probably the biggest takeaway there is just where you connect and whether you want the default to include those federal provisions or the default to exclude them. And then Oregon would have to choose to opt in one at a time rather than choose to opt out one at a time. And then there are a few states that do use their own starting point. But again, the states are utilizing kind of the federal law provisions because that helps with the definition of income and all that goes into the Internal Revenue Code is helpful to connect to as a starting point. So you don't have to put that all in Oregon statute. And then the last one I have here is state personal income tax collections. And this is in terms of all state tax revenue. So this wouldn't include fees, it's only tax revenue, and it wouldn't include any local revenue. So for Oregon, the biggest one, this doesn't include property taxes. For example, that's considered local revenue. But you can see Oregon, the idea here was just to show Oregon is the most dependent upon the personal income tax of all the states, at about 70%. And there are the handful of states, Alaska, Washington, certainly, that don't have the personal income tax, so they don't show up here. But it's just showing the 50 states and DC as well, their reliance on personal income taxes as a share of their total state tax revenue. So again, that excludes fees, so that changes it a little bit, but this is state dedicated. So in some sense, you can think general fund type revenue. But that was just to give the committee a sense of where Oregon lands compared to the other states. And those are all the slides I have prepared for you.
Thank you. Additional questions from the committee? Yes.
Just real quick. Thank you, Madam Chair. Kyle, you had mentioned earlier that there was a $200 per person personal tax credit. Is that correct? Something around there that's indexed to inflation. And so everybody who files gets that. I'm just wondering, from the committee's perspective, to simplify things, why not increase the marginal rate on all the margins that would be equivalent to that? I know it's not going to be $200, but it'd be something more than $200. So you don't even have to do that. It's just built into the marginal rate to begin with. For giving it away, why not do it on the front end rather than have people or accountants have to then take the credit? Just a thought.
Would you like, Mr. Allenack, would you like to help us figure out how to tee up that question for a response or a discussion?
Yeah,
well, it's an interesting point. It gets at some of the principles or the foundation of how the tax is structured. And so when we have kind of how much income is going to be taxed, so that you get to what income is going to be in the pot, and then the marginal rates, and we can set basically a zero rate bracket. I mean, mm-hmm. Kyle described our rates as 5, 7, 9, and 9.9.
Right.
And we have a standard deduction, which is effectively a zero rate bracket. So for each of the filers, the 2,200, 4,500 single or joint, since all filers get that, that's effectively a zero rate. So it certainly is possible to remove the personal exemption credit and then incorporate that into the rates. Some of the actual effects there, though, would be, right now, the personal exemption credit is capped. There's an end at 100,000 single filers and $200,000 of income for joint filers.
Okay.
So if you were to make that change, that would be one of the considerations that the committee would think about. Because right now, if I'm a single filer with $150,000 of income, I don't get the credit.
Gotcha. Okay.
If you pull it into the rate structure, then I would benefit from that.
I see.
There's a,
okay.
It's a policy discussion.
That clarifies why it may be done this way as opposed to another. Okay.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes,
presentation.
Thank you.
We're adjourned for the day.